نمام شیرای کشن بسایب کدیشی ماته باکتگرام تسوام ویتنامنه نمستی سرسود دیوی گاروانی کزارنه نردشه ششنی واری پاس ساکدیش تارنه شری کشن چیتنیا پربو نیچنند سری دویت کدارتار شیواشدی گور باکتگرند هری کشن 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 هری 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 راما هری راما Bhagavatam, Canto 1, Chapter 17, Verse 16. Ragyo hi paramo dharma. Sa dharma stana upalanam. Sa sato nyanyata sastram. Anapad yuttapaniha. Ragyo hi paramo dharma. Svadharma stanu palanam. Sasato nyanyata sastram. Anapad uttapan iha. Ragyo. Of the king or the executive head. He, certainly, Parama, supreme, and Dharma, occupational duty, Svadharmastha, one who is faithful in his prescribed duty, Anupalanam, giving protection always, Sasata, while ruling. Anyan, others, yata, according to Shastra, ruling of scriptures, anapadi, without danger, utpatan, persons going astray, iha, as a matter of fact. This one. Seem to be doing much. Translation: the supreme duty of the ruling king is to give all protection to law-abiding persons and to chastise those who stray from the ordinances of the scriptures in ordinary times when there is no emergency. For a part in the scriptures, there is mention of apadharma, or occupational duty, at times of extraordinary happenings. It is said that sometimes the great sage Vishvamitra had to live in the flesh of dogs in some extraordinary, dangerous position. In cases of emergency, one may be allowed to live in the flesh of animals of all description, but that does not mean there should be regular slaughterhouses to feed the animal eaters and that the system should be encouraged by the state. No one should try to live on flesh in ordinary times simply for the sake of the palate. If anyone does so, the king or the executive head should punish him for a gross enjoyment. There are regular scriptural injunctions for different persons engaged in different occupational duties, and one who follows them is called svadharmastha, or faithful in one's prescribed duties. In the Bhagavad Gita, it is advised that one should not give up his occupational prescribed duties, even if they are not always flawless. Such svadharma might be violated in cases of emergency, if one is forced by circumstances, but they cannot be violated in ordinary times. The state executive head is to see that such svadharma is not changed by the follower, whatever it may be, and he should give all protection to the followers of Svadharma. The violator is subject to punishment in terms of the Shastra, and the duty of the king is to see that everyone strictly follows his occupational duty as prescribed in the scripture. Translation: the supreme duty of the ruling king is to give all protection to the law-abiding persons and to chastise to those who stray from the ordinances of scripture in ordinary times, when there is no emergency. So this is a summary of some of the duties of a king or a ruler of a kingdom or a state. And then duty is mentioned here, his parama dharma, or his supreme duty, is protecting or maintaining the occupational duties of persons. They should stay within their svadharma. So we hear this word svadharma often mentioned. We see it in Bhagavad Gita. One should do one's svadharma and one should not do someone else's dharma, paradharma. Which means if you're a kshatriya, you should act as a kshatriya. You should not do the duties of a brahman or a sudra or a vaishya. And of course, even within svadharma, there may be categories. So there may be different types of vaishyas, like potters and weavers and whatever. So if you're a weaver, you stay a weaver and you don't become a potter. And if you're a you're a goldsmith, and you don't do something else. So in other words, your occupation is more or less fixed, and you get criticized if you start changing your occupation. This is quite different from modern society where everybody keeps changing their jobs all the time and they do whatever they want and they don't feel any sort of sinful reaction for just choosing any sort of job. So, and it would look a little bit restricting to put such confines on a person according to what the kingdom of the ruling of the kingdom. You can't change your job. And of course, another point is that this is always usually fixed by birth. If you're born in a potter family, you're a potter. That's it. You don't change your occupation for your life. You can't aspire for anything higher than that. Or if you're a goldsmith, then you're a goldsmith for your whole life, etc. And your son's a goldsmith, and his son's a goldsmith, like this. So you carry on your family traditions. The positive point of this, of course, is that is there some sort of stability in the family. You don't have to think about what job you're going to do. You just do whatever your father did, that's all. And you don't have to worry about your education because you get educated by your family members. So in that sense, we could say it's good. The negative aspect, of course, is that if a person is not satisfied in that particular job, even if he's born within that family, then he feels repressed. Of course, the other rule is that it's according to your gunas or your qualities, not just your birth. However, what has come to pass is that usually it's simpler just to say by birth and not worry about the qualities. The parents won't look at the qualities and see if they're different. They'll just assume that their children are like they are and therefore they'll do the same things. So in this way we have the varna system by birth or jati rather than by guna. But technically it should be a combination of both. On the other hand, of course, we see that in general, according to the parents, the children would be somewhat similar. So we could say that in general they would follow the same characteristics and therefore the same occupation. Unfortunately, in Kali Yuga, even the jati doesn't work properly. And people that are born in the family don't have the same qualities. And this is because of the irregularity in the whole marriage system itself and the mixture of castes, etc. Of course, that's in India. In the Western, there's no concept of that at all, really. It is unpredictable what type of children are going to come out of a particular parent, even in India, because the whole system itself is corrupted. And the parents aren't following their duties properly also, so with respect to the children. So therefore, in general, in Kali Yuga, the whole system doesn't really work, and we cannot predict what a person is going to be according to family or jati. And therefore, we would have to depend on qualities. But then unfortunately, if you just depend on qualities, the whole advantage of that system is broken because, as I said, there's no necessity for the children to think about what they have to do because they would automatically take the occupation of their parents and get the education there and get the protection and get the support. But if the children are completely something different, then that's not going to be there. So the family system itself gets broken up in Kali Yuga where everyone chooses their own occupation, even if it is according to their qualities. So therefore we get a disruption of the family system also, by choosing your own occupation, so to speak. So we end up with a lot of problems in Kali Yuga. The system doesn't quite work in a normal way. So, but when the whole system is intact and the king is enforcing the system and the marriages go according to caste, etc., then one can expect that the system would work to a large degree. And of course, there are exceptions, and we see even in the Bhagavatam, some of the sons of Rishabha became Brahminical and sages, or others became Kshatriyas or whatever. So, in those times also, there were cases where they did not stick to the dharma of their parents. So, anyway, this is the one of the things which is emphasized in that system. You have your Swadharma. So one is the occupation itself by which you maintain yourself. And that, of course, is important because everybody has to live, or at least the men have to support themselves, and then they have to support their family. So in human society, basically the unit is a family unit, where there's a husband and wife and children. And in ancient times, it was the husband who supports the wife and children. So in that particular system, and there was an emphasis upon occupational duty. You had to work to support your family somehow or other. And if that doesn't happen, of course, then there's no family, and consequently there's no population. Or the population of results is useless. It is varna sankara. It is a useless population because the children become unproductive. And they don't work or can't work. And they can't support themselves. So then the whole society is, if the whole society is like that with the useless population, then there's no country at all. So that system has to be enforced properly by the king. And consequently, it can operate properly. And when that system breaks down, then it is very difficult to implement. So the Bhagavatam itself shows in the various cantos, here we're only in the first canto, but starting with the third, fourth, fifth, sixth, seventh, eighth, ninth cantos, it traces the lineage from the various Manus, starting with Swayambhuva Manu and his descendants, and Dhruva, etc., and up to Prithu, and they were actually before Prithuvena, and there was a corruption in the line, and then Prithu appeared and reconstituted that line of kings. And then the other Manus came and established their lines. And then Vaivasvata Manu comes and as the seventh Manu and establishes his line, etc. And this is traced in the ninth canto up until Krishna's time. And he comes out of that lineage also, as well as the Pandavas and others. And then later it's traced onward after this, what happened. From Dwapara Yuga to Kali Yuga. And it just shows that the whole system fell apart, and there were no great kings anymore, and people assassinated other people and became kings, and so the line of kings was lost. Yeah. It also mentions that there is a descendant of Manu still living, and he's hiding somewhere in the Himalayas. And he will manifest himself in Satyayuga. So in other words, the line of kings from Manu, Vaivasvata Manu, will continue, but not in Kali Yuga. He's hiding now and he won't manifest until Satyayuga. So, because the king is absent, therefore we have to assume the system will not be intact. And so the whole Svadharma system and all the duties that go with it are not going to be, one cannot really practice them. It's very difficult to follow that system. Okay. So what do we do in Kali Yuga? We can't figure out what our Svadharma is and whatever, and we can't maintain a system at all because there's no enforcing a person on top to do it properly. Very difficult. No qualified leaders or kings are available. So fortunately, in spite of the fact that the Varna system gets broken up, in another sense, it doesn't mean that dharma has ended. So we're speaking about dharma and svadharma, about occupational duties, etc. So the focus on those duties is, as I said, maintenance, support the family members, and then consequently the district and the city and the nation, etc. Make a strong family unit, make a strong country, etc. That is basically artha. So we have dharma to support artha. And then when you get a little more advanced, you get kama. You get extras. Extra enjoyment beyond that. Of course, then we get an opposite thing. People want the artha and the kama without the dharma. So that is what happens in Kali Yuga. Or in a civilization beyond the kings in ancient times. That is, the people who are outside of the civilization, they were considered mlechas and others, they would be just having artha and kama with no dharma. Rules and regulations of occupation, all this were absent. So anyway, these are part of that system. That is the rules for occupation, etc. Now that part is very difficult to implement. The maintenance part. So it's a little bit haphazard in Kali Yuga. The other part of the Dharma is the rules for sense control, which are related to the rules of occupation also, because different occupations and different varnas will have different rules. Sudras have one set of rules because they're incapable of following all the rules, and Brahmins have a different set of rules, a more complex set of rules, a lot of rules to follow because they're capable of controlling their senses more. So according to the different types of persons, then we also get all sorts of different types of rules to follow. But even that is difficult to do in Kali Yuga, because nobody knows who they are. Is he a Brahmin? Is he a Sudra? Is he, what is he? So what set of rules are you going to follow? The complex set of rules for the Brahmins or the Sudra rules? And of course the other aspect of Kali Yuga is everybody is lazy. So they'll choose the lowest possible category. We're all Sudras and we don't have to follow any rules. So even the other aspects of Dharma and sort of sense control are also very difficult to implement in Kali Yuga. And everything goes down to the minimum. Minimum sense of occupation, minimum the sense of sense control. So everybody's Sudra, basically, in Kali Yuga. And that's what the Kshatras say, everyone is born Sudra, more or less, and they could get qualification by their education and whatever later on, but even then they generally revert back to Sudra occupations and Sudra rules, because it's easier. No one to enforce anything. And nobody really knows what is their proper situation in terms of Varna or Ashram. So again, even that, beyond the occupations, it is also difficult to institute the other rules of sense control, because they are related to the Varnas themselves. And the Varnas are all confused. So that aspect of Dharma also is difficult. So what do we have left of that system at all? In one sense, we can't do anything because the king is absent. And the king is very necessary to institute that system. And there's no qualified king left because he's hiding in the Himalayas. He doesn't want to come, doesn't want to appear. He's voluntarily absented himself, taking leave of absence for another 400,000 years. So very difficult to do anything in terms of Varnashram system. And of course we know that, as the discussion here is about the appearance of Kali, and how Parikshit was maintaining Dharma, but then Kali comes along, and after Maharaj Pariksha disappears, then Kali is rampant, which means destruction of everything. Four legs of Dharma are gone. Three quarters of Dharma are missing. So it's very difficult to reestablish, four legs of Dharma when the influence of Kali is to chop off all the legs of Dharma. Very difficult. Of course, we can say there's one quarter left of Dharma. There's some little bit of principles left, a little bit of cleanliness, a little bit of tapas, a little bit of mercy, etc. But very little in Kali Yuga. A few people will have that, and most people won't. So, in that sense, Dharma is also difficult to implement. So, what to do in that case? The Supreme Lord has various methods of showing his compassion to the living entities. And this is the whole purpose of Bhagavatam. It describes how he creates the material world. There's different topics of Bhagavatam like Sarga and Visarga. Mahavishnu glancing is Sarga, and then Brahma creation is Visarga, creating the living entities. He creates the planetary systems, which is called Sthana in Canto 5 in Bhagavatam, where you get all the different planetary systems and Bhumandala and different Varshas and different Dvipas where different living entities live. So Brahma creates places for everyone to live. He creates the living entities and among the human species, and he also creates the Varnas and the Ashramas and everything so that you can maintain yourself. And of course he maintains the plants and animals as well in different lokas according to their gunas. So beyond that, the Lord does not abandon the material world and just leave the jivas there by themselves. He creates systems to help them and to maintain the human population. So, of course, one is the manus. So, therefore, he has a whole line of manus, and that's discussed, and that's one of the topics of the Bhagavatam, that is the manvantara, what happens during Manu's reign. He protects the living entities, and particularly the devotees. That is technically called poshana, one of the topics of Bhagavatam. And that's illustrated by the fact that we have, within the material world, the Lord comes and he protects the devotees, as he protects Indra. He protects Ajamil, for instance, in the sixth canto, Bhagavatam, through the holy name. So the Lord has different means of showing his compassion to the living entities in the material world. And one of the systems is manus. The manus establish this dharma, system of dharma through the kings. But in Kali Yuga, the dharma disappears. The nature of material world and time is to destroy everything. So dharma gets destroyed. And later on, it gets restored again by the will of the Lord. Satyuga starts and the manu comes back and is restored again. So he doesn't abandon completely, he restores it again. But anyway, in Kali Yuga, 1,000 times in the day of Brahma, we do have a bad situation where even the kings don't rule anymore, and that system that the manus established seems to disappear for some period of time, 400,000 years or so. So what to do in that period? The dharma is gone in that period. But the Lord does not abandon the living entities, even in that case. So what is left is still another aspect of dharma, and that is the dharma which is mentioned in Bhagavad Gita, where Krishna says, give up all dharmas and just surrender to me. So that the highest dharma is bhakti. So even if you don't have this dharma intact in Kali Yuga, you still do the highest aspect, the essence of all the dharmas and the essence of the Varnashram system and essence of jnana and yoga, etc., is bhakti. So that still remains and is nourished by the Supreme Lord even in all the Kali Yugas, when there is no more regular dharma with all occupational duties and sense control, etc. The Lord still manages to preserve the highest dharma, that is bhakti. So we should not feel discouraged by the lack of a Varnashram system in Kali Yuga. We should understand that the essence of dharma is bhakti, and that continues even in Kali Yuga. And of course, it is said that Kali Yuga is full of faults, but the great guna, or the great quality of Kali Yuga, as we have Sankirtan, chanting in the holy name of the Lord, which is the essence of bhakti. So in other words, the Lord doesn't abandon the living entities, but he supports them, and in Kali Yuga he supports the dharma of chanting of the holy name. And therefore the Lord comes as Yuga avatar to propagate that, and support that, spread that, emphasize that. So of course the holy name is always there, it's in the scriptures and they always chant, but in Kali Yuga this becomes the saving method for the people of Kali Yuga. they don't have any dharma, or mixed up dharma at best, but everyone can chant the name of the Lord. So that's the substitute. It's not only a substitute, but it is better than a substitute, because it's better than just dharma itself. There is no dharma, and it's very difficult to reestablish the dharma, but instead of that, we can establish bhakti through Nam Sankirtan. Because if we do that, that's the essence of dharma. So even if you don't have everything else, all the other aspects of dharma and the other yugas, it doesn't matter. We got the essence of everything. And of course, Lord Chaitanya says, well, I'm not interested in this Varnashram dharma and all of this. So even if you do have the whole dharma intact and stuff to you, or trait to you, or dwarpa yuga, still, that's not the essence of everything. The essence is still bhakti there. So with or without that whole system of dharma, still, bhakti has to be performed. If it isn't, then the whole thing is useless. Everything else is useless. Now, fortunately, the monks are both, they're dual. They have a dual role. They establish dharma, they're also devotees of the Lord. So those who are more advanced and just not interested in maintaining their bodies and whatever in the dharma system, then they're encouraged to also be devotees of the Lord, because the king is a devotee of the Lord. And we have ideal examples of that in the form of the Pandavas and Parikshit, who's the subject of this section here. Parikshit was an ideal king in the sense that he was following Varnashram, Dharma, etc. At the same time, he was an ideal devotee. Set a good example as a devotee. And so the Manus and their descendants were actually good examples for everyone, because they follow both things, the dharma plus bhakti. In Kali Yuga, then, the kings are absent, and even if the kings are there, they have no bhakti. they're not a good example of anything, either dharma or bhakti, neither of them. So that makes it added difficulty. So what do we do in the absence of that is that we do have examples in the form of devotees of the Lord who aren't kings. We just have devotees. So the saving grace of Kali Yuga is the devotees of the Lord following Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. And they can establish the highest dharma, that is devotional service to the Lord through the Sankirtan movement. In that sense, we don't have to feel too sad that the whole system is gone, because we've still got the essence of everything. So, here we find the, it's talking about the protecting the citizens and chastising those who stray from the scriptures. So this is the kingly duty, whatever, to chastise some and to protect others. We find in the Lord Chaitanya's description in the 11th canto, where it describes the Yuga Avatar, there it says that the Lord comes and, you know, the people worship through Sankirtan, intelligent people worship him through Sankirtan, and he is, of course, he's Krishna Varna, Krishna Krishna. He is golden, not black in complexion, but he is actually Krishna himself. So this is a little bit of a special category of Yuga Avatar during Sankirtan, because it's not the ordinary Yuga Avatar propagating Sankirtan. It is none other than Krishna himself. So it's a very special blessing then for this Kali Yuga, because it's not just Avatar of the Lord, it is Swayam Bhagavan Krishna coming as Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, appearing as Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. So very special. So not only we get Yuga Dharma and whatever in essence in bhakti, we also get the devotion to Krishna as a result of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu's appearance. So this is very special Kali Yuga. And not just a normal Kali Yuga where we get Sankirtan, but Sankirtan directed towards Krishna. So that makes it even better. So in that description, it talks about the Supreme, the Lord Chaitanya, and he's surrounded by his associates and sub-associates who are like his weapons. So instead of the king with his weapons, we have Sankirtan movement and the Lord Chaitanya with his associates. They're like the weapons or whatever. So we don't use the devotees are not like the king who has his armies and his weapons to chastise the miscreants and protect the devotees. Rather, we do the whole operation with the Sankirtan movement and the devotees there, not with the political or the military aspects. This is the movement of Lord Chaitanya. His weapons are his devotees chanting Sankirtan. So instead of the protection of this type of king here who is chastising the miscreants with weapons, etc., and that way protecting Dharma, we propagate the highest Dharma, and we give mercy to people and protect people by giving knowledge of Krishna, spreading the Sankirtana movement and giving knowledge of Krishna. This is the way in which we protect people and conquer over the demons by converting them and whatever, giving them Sankirtana and making them favorable. So this we also see, of course, in Lord Chaitanya's life. An example of Jagai and Madai, Lord Chaitanya had his chakra weapon, but he didn't use it. As Lord Chaitanya, he's very merciful, so he makes them into devotees. He doesn't kill the demons. He makes them into devotees. So in this way, rather than the normal king who kills the miscreants like Kali or whatever, the devotees of the Lord spread Sankirtan, and in this way, by hearing that, the demon has a change of heart. Now, of course, we do have this aparad. Don't preach to the demons. Don't give instruction in the holy name to the demons. So then we go, well, we shouldn't let the demons hear Hare Krishna or whatever. So, no, the prohibition is not that they can't hear. Everybody can hear. Even the demons can hear the holy name. That's allowed. That's not offense to have them hear the holy name. Name of the Lord. And they also get benefit from it. And of course, the people who were in between, they get great benefit from it. Like Ajamil, he just chanted the name of Narayana and he got rid of all of his karmas instantly. So if an innocent person hears, he gets great advantage. Even if a demon hears, he gets some advantage. And that is illustrated in the example of Shishupala when Krishna was present. Shishupala saw Krishna, he heard about Krishna, he heard Krishna's name, and he hated Krishna. But in that hatred, when he chanted Krishna's name, he kept chanting that name because Krishna is so attractive. He couldn't help chant the name in hatred because Krishna's name is so attractive and Krishna's form is so attractive that he kept chanting that name. And as a result of that, in spite of his hatred, all of his karmas and everything disappeared. And when everything was gone, all the sin was gone, then Krishna threw his Sudarshan Chakra, which is a weapon to kill him, but actually didn't kill him. It touched him and gave him prema. And then he went to the spiritual world. So there, Krishna actually didn't really kill him. He blessed him with prema through his Sudarshan Chakra. So, therefore, the holy name actually is very, very powerful even to do something to the demons. However, the restriction is in the ninth offense of the holy name that we don't give teachings to the demons immediately. In other words, you don't take them and initiate them and tell them, in spite of knowing that they got a very bad heart, to say you're a devotee of the Lord and give teachings and initiate them or whatever. You don't do that. But we let them hear the holy name. And when they get purified and purified and purified, then when we see that their hearts are changed, then we can actually preach to them favorably and give them good instructions, and they won't create offense. So, therefore, Sankirtan is even for the demons. It is a weapon for the demons to change their heart or whatever, and eventually they can, when they have a change of heart, then we can preach to them more seriously. In this way, we can save them. So this way we give, instead of simply punishing, we actually begin to nourish their devotion. So basically, the sankirtan is what? Protection, nourishing and protecting everybody, even the demons. So that is through the mercy of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. And the special blessing is that not only the demons also get advantage, but even the demons get the highest advantage because they get the opportunity to worship Krishna, which is rare. And it doesn't happen in other Kali Yugas. But even the demons here get the unqualified, most unqualified persons get the chance to worship Krishna. And this is by the mercy of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, because he is Mahavadanya. He is most merciful, most compassionate, even more compassionate than Krishna. So Krishna appears, but then people cannot understand. So Lord Chaitanya comes and he even opens up, he gives access to Krishna for the most fallen persons, the great demons also. Which is illustrated in Lord Chaitanya's pastimes. So therefore, though Kali Yuga is very bad and it is impossible now to resurrect the normal Dharma, we do have the highest Dharma. Not just Sankirtan and Bhakti, but the Dharma in the sense of worshipping Krishna. That's the very, very highest level of Dharma. So there's no loss in Kali Yuga because we have this very, very great gift. Okay. Any questions?
But I have a couple of questions. One is, when we say everything is a part and parcel of the Supreme Lord, everything comes from Him. Given that in mind, what is the definition of a demon? Because he is also coming from Him. That's one. The second question is, when Prabhupada says, we talk about Varnashram Dharma, Prabhupada emphasizes on setting up of Devi Varnashrama. What should be the duty of a devotee? Mm-hmm. If we don't understand even Varnashrama because it is not possible, practical, how do we and what should a devotee do to establish a Devi Varnashrama?
Okay, the first question is that about the demons, that they're also part of the Lord. Yes, that's true. Prakriti is also part of the Lord. Which is achit, it's not even conscious. At least the demons have consciousness. Prakriti has no consciousness at all. It's this inert matter. It's also part of the Lord. So everything is part of the Lord, and it is the Lord in one sense, because we are a Chintaveda Veda Tattva. There's oneness. Everything is part of the Lord. Everything is the Lord. Not just part, it is the Lord in one sense. That's oneness. At the same time, there's difference. So, the oneness is this, that because they are Shaktis, and we have Achit Shakti, we have Jiva Shakti, they are one with the Lord. There's oneness there. But then there's also difference. Simultaneously, there's difference. Those Shaktis all also can be separated. They can be separated more than the Chit Shakti, which is the spiritual Shakti. Because we see their functions are quite different. And Achit Shakti, of course, is unconscious and it manifests the material world. Manifests Maya. And we have the Jiva Shakti, which is similar to the Chit Shakti in one sense, but it's also different because we have individuals who can be Bahirmukha, opposed to the Lord, ignorant. And all Jivas are not ignorant, and some are Nityasiddhas and some are Muktas, whatever, but we do have some Jivas who are completely ignorant of the Supreme Lord, even though they are Chit particles. So, this is a Shakti, a particular Shakti of the Lord. So it's just the nature of that Shakti, that we have Jivas who are ignorant, and some are more ignorant than others. So in the material world, everyone is more or less covered by ignorance, but then we have some who are completely opposed to the Lord. These are the great demons, completely hostile to the Lord. We have others in the middle, who are neither like or hate or anything, they just don't care. And then we have those that are favorable slightly, and have some inclination towards religion or whatever. And then we have those who are even more favorable in the sense they got good knowledge and they actually worship the Lord very seriously. So we get all sorts of Jivas in the material world. That is the nature of this the Jiva Shakti, that it manifests these particles who are individuals. And therefore, there will be varieties. So it's the nature of the Shakti itself. But they're part of the Lord. Yeah. But not an intimate part in the same as we find Antaranga Shakti. Yeah. Or the Bahiranga Shakti is completely opposite. That's the material energy. And the Jiva Shakti is in the middle, kind of. It's like the Lord because we have conscious particles, but unlike the Lord because they're completely dependent on the Lord and liable to fall into ignorance of various sorts. The other question about Daivi Varnashram, this is a controversial question. I don't know if anyone has solved it. Just what does that Daivi Varnashram mean and how do you institute or whatever? But I think, in essence, we cannot replace bhakti with varnashram in any sense of the term. It can only support, in any case, whatever system we establish can only support, help support bhakti, and it cannot replace the bhakti, otherwise we're lost. So, in other words, we can use elements of that system which are favorable to our devotional development, either as individuals or as groups. So we can use some of those rules. We can use the rules for conduct in an individual family, how the members of the family interact, or the duties of the husband, the duties of the father or whatever to the children, the duty of the children to the father, the duty of the wife to the husband, the wife to the husband, etc. Then we take those rules and instill as much as possible, not completely, but as much as possible as practical in this yuga. We could use those. It will probably be very difficult to institute the Svadharma rules, you know, according to birth, again, it goes according to birth, etc., etc. That's difficult to follow. So all we can do is give people occupations according to their guna. That's about all you can do. So those aspects can be the aspects of sense control as much as possible. Do this, don't do this, whatever, like this. Avoid violence, avoid sinful activities. We can follow the standards of varnashram as much as possible for that. So, in terms of conduct, and in terms of family life, interact social interactions, to some degree we can follow those rules. But as far as the strict varnas, probably not. It'd be very difficult to do so. And anyway, we don't have a king. And to establish such a kingdom, then you would have to overthrow the government and do that, then it would be a problem. You'd be branded as a revolutionary and get thrown in jail or whatever. So there's a lot of problems in instituting that on a large scale.
Being the best of the demons, or the most devious, aren't necessarily presented as demons. They might present as a reasonable, nice person, and we might start.
Absolutely, yeah. Yeah.
So, and if they want to actually come into the movement or do this, they're not going to reveal themselves the best of them or the most devious. So how do we discern if we're preaching to a demon or if we're preaching to some people?
Well, all we can do is use the best of our intelligence or whatever. And we may make a mistake. You're liable to make mistakes also. And only later maybe we discover the real truth or whatever. When that takes place, then we have to separate ourselves from such persons.
So in that case, are we guilty of breaking the mind regulation because they're presented this way and tricked us, or are we not?
Well, it's less of an offense in one sense, just as if you commit a sinful activity unknowingly, it's not as bad as if you do it knowingly, like that. So if you make the offense unknowingly, then not much can be done about that. It's not really an offense.
And the other question is, if they are disguised like this and they actually come into the movement, would the fact that they're in the movement for that length of time actually, they become, this bhakti would have an effect on them in the chanting, because they'd have to pretend like they were, so that actually becomes
a bhakti in any case. It is possible in some cases, but it would depend on the intensity of their deviousness and hatred or whatever. So anything is possible, even the worst demon can become a devotee like Shishupala. Yeah, so it's possible for someone to change, definitely. This isn't working again. It's red now. Is the battery gone?
Before there should be a little more time. Yeah. We have many problems like that, historical, modern historical perspective versus the Puranic perspective, not only in terms of the yugas, whatever, but of course in terms of the whole creation of the material world and the structure of the universe, the planetary systems, and whatever. There is some sort of difference of opinion. One answer, of course, that we'll find in Druta Karma's works, that he says there are discrepancies, even in, let's say, archaeology and whatever, about the dating of all these different things and who was present when and whatever. You'll see footprints along with the dinosaurs, which seems impossible according to modern theory of when humans evolved and mammals evolved. But then you'll see footprints, fossil footprints near the dinosaurs or something like this. So, you know, or in the deposits of coal, which were probably before the dinosaurs, you'll find jewelry. Gold jewelry mixed up in there. So how did the jewelry get among the coal or something like that? So we do get contradictory evidence even in archaeology and whatever, but usually it's suppressed or ignored as an anomaly that we cannot explain at the moment. So we cannot always take these scientific versions of history itself as literal. They may have some aspects true, but other parts may be a little bit not quite accurate.
Maharaj, you mentioned the passing of Shishupal, where he got prema with his Sudarshan Chakra. So did he get Sahitya? The first?
He actually went spiritual world.
Mm-hmm. There are a couple of versions that say he got Sahitya.
Yeah, Vasayuja in another means closeness to the Lord. That's how Jiva Goswami interprets it. It means to be with. Yuj means to join together, so you meet. In other words, he was also on Jayan Vijay in that particular thing, so he got a form. But it's not that the comment is that not every yuga cycle does, or every day of Brahma, when Sishupal appears, he's not always from the spiritual world. Usually it's just demons, and only one time Jayan Vijay were cursed and they came into the material world, so they don't fall out every day. They don't fall out of the spiritual world every day. So usually it's demons who are real demons, you know. And then the Lord is merciful and they get prema and go to the spiritual world.
To a person who has a scientific mind, he wants to know, explore, and then believe. A person does not deny the existence of the spiritual realm, but he wants to explore and find out. Okay. That's what I meant by science, not just the material science.
Mm-hmm.
A person who has that kind of a mindset, how do we explain most of the, he calls the stories in the scriptures fairy tales. How do we explain to him or explain to that person that is this really fairy tales or is there some truth behind it? He wants to find out, is it better than just merely believing in them?
We do have to have an inquisitive mind. We cannot have blind faith in everything. At the same time, we cannot expect that everything is going to be proven according to material logic or scientific method. The normal scientific method. So therefore that person cannot outright say it's a fairy tale. Otherwise, he is imposing his scientific material method upon the scripture. A prejudice is already there if he does so. So if he comes with an open mind, fine. So the only way you can approach this subject is by participation and practice. In other words, you have to reach a level of faith and realization before you can actually judge, is this true or not? Okay? So then you will have to do it through practice, become a devotee, and try it out and see. Does it actually have an effect? As proven, and then all this other stuff is supporting knowledge. Now, whether it is true in the normal way, like does Indraloka exist, etc., we cannot prove it scientifically because our scientific, it's material, but the scientific instruments we have are not of that category to prove those things. What to speak of spiritual things? Goloka, you cannot prove that at all because it's not material completely. So we have different levels of material energy and we also have spiritual energy. So the higher material energy we cannot prove, nor can we prove the spiritual energy. So there's a great limitation. However, the human mind is quite flexible, and by the mercy of the Supreme Lord, we can use that mind in such a way that we can get realization. Of course, ultimately the realization is not coming to the mind, but to the Atma, which influences the mind. So, if we do access the Atma itself and develop realization, we can begin to appreciate higher material realms, like seeing Indraloka or whatever, or even going in and perceiving spiritual world with the Supreme Lord and spiritual planets. But it requires, you know, different proof. Experience not the material senses, but with the Jiva himself, the Atma. So the person will have to get that conviction that to develop spiritual senses rather than material senses if he wants to get proof of these things.
Does this Kaliyuga exist in other planetary systems?
Apparently it's only in Bharatvarsha. It's only in Bharatvarsha. Even the other Varshas are considered to be what? Boma Svarga. Svarga on Earth. The other, you know, places on the other eight Varshas are considered to be heavenly planets. The Devatas, after they expire, there are people that go up there after they use up their punya, and then they fall down to the Boma Svarga for some time. So they don't experience the same yuga cycles as we do. Only Varsha gets that. Generally, yeah. Yuga Dharma doesn't operate there. So that is why it's considered a very special place in one sense, because there's a special opportunity for getting the highest thing now in this Kali Yuga through Sankirtan. Special portal to Goloka in this Kali Yuga. It's not open for other times and other places. This particular time it's open, get there. Other times not, it's closed. Okay. Hare Krishna.
Please join me, Swami Maharaj.